Welcome to the NSPCC Learning Podcast, where we share learning and expertise in child protection from inside and outside of the organisation. We aim to create debate, encourage reflection, and share good practice on how we can all work together to keep babies, children, and young people safe.
Hi, and welcome to the latest NSPCC Learning Podcast. This is the second of three episodes which are focusing on harmful sexual behaviour, also known as HSB. Back in January 2020, we published a series of podcasts on harmful sexual behaviour, and to date these have been amongst our most well-received episodes, and so we've recorded three new podcasts on HSB. Katie Tompkinson and Rome Wolfe are social workers and children's practitioners at our Stoke Service Centre, and both have years of experience working on HSB services with children and young people. The second in the series focuses on some of the specific session plans and ideas that Katie and Rowan use to support their work with children and young people. For information, this episode was recorded in March 2021.
This is part two of our direct work podcasts, and in this podcast we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the sort of specific session plans and ideas that we might use to support our work with children and young people. I think the first thing to think about, and we've talked more about it in kind of podcast one, whilst we're going to offer you some session plans, it's really useful to have a couple that you might be able to use, have a backup plan, have a contingency.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than going in and a session just falls flat and you get nowhere and you've not got a backup. And I think in this work, it's so sensitive. If you've not got that kind of plan in your back pocket to bring out, you can just be left sitting feeling quite awkward. So I do like to have a contingency. And the more you do the work, the less you need to plan that contingency.
Yeah.
I think when you first start, you need to have a lot more sort of prep.
Definitely.
So I think what we wanted to think about was a combination of stuff. So how you might do some initial sessions, but also, I suppose, more HSB-specific examples of the sorts of sessions that we've done. So we talked about some of the initial stuff of the kind of getting to know you, things that might be safer topics, but also what we wanted to do is also think about how we could put kind of a harmful sexual behaviour specific change to that piece of work. So yeah. I think one of the things we talked about was timelines. So you use timelines, Katie. How do you use them where just to do a timeline, and then how might you change that to sort of develop that idea further?
So I think helping them understand the concept of timelines is really useful because you can use them in so many different ways. So one of the initial sessions I might do with a child or young person is with a big piece of paper, if possible, if you can have a room that sort of allows that. I would draw
wallpaper is quite good.
Wallpaper's a really good one, back of wallpaper, lining paper, and some sort of whiteboard markers, not Sharpies, I would say, just because of it's, you know, it doesn't wash out and families don't thank you for it. But a big line down the middle, and start off marking kind of chronologically their age and ask them to think about, you know, the important things that happened to them chronologically in their age, and marking it off on the line. But the reason I do the line in the middle is that depending on whether the memory is kind of a good memory or a bad memory, they might put it above for a good memory and a bad and below for a bad memory. And I might ask them to score it. So you talked about scaling questions before. Yeah. So I might say, like, out of 10, how good was that memory? Out of 10, how bad was that memory? That's not right for some children. So I think you use your professional judgment in that moment about whether that's going to be helpful for them. I think generally to begin with, this children sort of tend to be like, I can't think of anything. So I ask them, oh, well, what was your first memory? Or can you tell me about a Christmas that was like really happy, or one of your birthdays? Or
so do you do it with, like, so I'd often do it with post-it notes, because I think whenever you remember life events, often you forget the order and then you're like, oh no, that happened before. So I find doing post-it notes quite helpful because you can move them up and down the timeline to get the order correct.
I think I really like doing it with post-it notes, and that works really well for some children. I've had other children that have spent half the session creating and decorating their own timeline, and that's really important to them too. So I don't really mind. For me, what's important is that engaging conversation with the child, and whatever way we get from like A to B, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But post-its, you're right, is a good one, because it means you can sort of move those things and around.
Sometimes I'll also write things that I know have happened to them. And it might be a really positive thing, like say, for example, you know that it was the first time they played in the school football team and they were really proud of it. And that's just come out in general conversation. I might have that ready on a bit of post-it notes so that you're showing that you've listened to things that they've said before, but it also can give them a starting point of something to put on. And then you ask them about that experience. Equally, sometimes when you know it's a negative experience that they're going to struggle to bring up themselves, that might be a way of introducing it.
Yeah. And I think it's important that if they do name negative experiences, that if this is an initial session and you don't want to kind of explore that more, you maybe thank the child for being really brave in sharing that with you and sort of recognise that that wasn't nice and that you're sorry that that happened to them. It's better than saying nothing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And also maybe reflecting, you know, we can talk about that if you want to, but we don't have to, or we can think about it in the sessions going forward, just so that kind of you're acknowledging what you're saying. Because sometimes as people, we avoid the difficult.
Absolutely.
But I think it's important that we give them a response. But for some young people, you know, think about working with young people who've said that they understood timelines, they did it in history. I think I said, oh, we're going to do a timeline next week. Oh, yeah, I've done one of them in history. Great. And then we get in session, I think, no, this concept is just not going to work for them. And then sometimes I've really pared it back and I've just done good and bad memories.
Yeah, and just keep it simple.
Get rid of the chronology altogether, because for some children, that's a barrier to them being able to explore their life experiences.
So you use timelines to look at the past. Do you ever use them to look at the future?
Yes. So like I say, I think that would be one that I would do initially as a getting to know you session. And I think once they're sort of comfortable with that in the session and we're having a really positive session, I might say, oh, can you just sort of put on your timeline where the harmful sexual behaviour happened? And I might not use harmful sexual behaviour as a language. I might say, you know, where the incident happened with your brother or sister or whatever it may have been, and ask them to put it on. So it's just naming it and that kind of gentle reminder that this is the purpose of the work. And if there's been more than one incident, again, gently sort of encourage them to plot all those things on the timeline if they can.
You're looking for triggers and things. Do you matching that with life events or...?
I think initially I'd just use it as a session just to sort of get them to get more comfortable in kind of exploring it and talking about it. And then as the sessions go forward, I think what's really helpful is doing like a really pared back timeline just about kind of the day or the hour that the sexual behaviour took place. So then you're really paring back, what were you thinking, what happened in that timeline, the events leading up to what happened and afterwards. So you can really sort of drill down into what was going on for them, what they were thinking and feeling. But that would be a later session.
Yeah.
And then also, I think, like you say, future timelines as well. It might be something that you do later in the work when you're talking to things. It
might even be the intervention that you move on to that. But you use the same timeline. That's the beauty of getting a wallpaper or something, because that piece of paper is going to keep going and it can grow during your work.
Yeah. And it's quite empowering for young people as well, because it's helping them believe that they can choose the path that they want to, and that encouragement of this can be your life, you can do this. And
so I often split mine into two. So I stick with that positive negative theme, that you've got the line that goes through the middle, then I'll do the future timeline that's positive with no HSB, and the future timeline if further HSB occurs. And my aim would be to really get an understanding of their aspirations, what they want from their life, and build that into the most vivid picture I can, this positive future. So, you know, do they see themselves with a family or a partner? What job do they want to be doing? And for some kids, they have such low self-esteem, they don't see any future. And then that's our job to look at, well, how can we build that over the course of the work? You don't have to do it in that one session. You don't fix everything. But it might be, right, this is something we need to really think about how we can develop their talents and get them to start to see that there's a future. But equally, also I'm saying, I want to check that they understand the consequences of further behaviour and how that might impact their future. So what I try and do is never tell children that because they've displayed this behaviour, their life's over. I think some of them think, especially if they've ended up with a conviction of some sort, that's it, my life's over. And it could be that some of their career opportunities have changed because of that conviction, and that's really difficult, and you might have to support them with that. But also, there's lots of things that's still open to them that are positive career opportunities. But I'd spend less time on the negative, but I'd spend some time thinking about, well, if there was further behaviours, how might that impact on your life, your relationships, your career options? And then you're basically saying to them, which path do you want to choose?
Yeah.
Very few are going to say, well, I definitely want to choose the negative path.
Yeah.
They're going to want the positive. And then it's like, well, this work is how you commit to that. This work is how you start to make steps towards that positive future. So you're always trying to bring them back to, like, life can change.
In a positive way. And that kind of support. And it's my job to help you on that path, isn't it? So they don't feel like they're overwhelmed and on their own with it as well. In terms of kind of some of the initial sessions, the getting to know you sessions, do you do kind of genograms, family trees?
Yeah, it varies. So sometimes what I'll do, if it's a sort of a, what I call a littly, so primary school, I might try and do it in a much more fun way. So say, for example, I know that they're really into football, and there's a particular team that they've got. I've gone and sort of downloaded the little shirts of a particular football team, and I'll print loads and loads of them off, and then they can put their family football team out rather than their family tree. And then that means that each member of the family gets their own football shirt, but it just brings a bit more engagement. Others I might actually make an actual tree and the leaves are... Others, I just draw it out simply on a piece of paper. And I think it's don't be afraid to draw it for them. You know, this isn't a class exercise at school where they have to have completed the work themselves. If all they can do is mumble some responses, that's a win. That's good.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do the drawing for them. I don't...
Yeah, I would give them the choice. Do you want to do it or do you want me to do it? And it doesn't matter either way. Yeah.
And if they want to do it, great. And let them decorate it and all the rest. It's quite useful, I think, when we do family trees, genograms, however you do that, is to think about how you then can then bring the HSB in later. So initially, it's just to find out who's in their family. Sometimes we'll use things like feelings bear cards and say which bear represents each member of the family. So you're getting a sense of whether they have a happy bear, a safe bear, an angry-looking bear. And that can be quite telling, really, about how they see those people in their family or objects to represent. So an example would be someone who had a scouring pad with a spongy bit on one side, and it was like picking that for somebody, and it's like, because you never know what you're going to get, whether you get the rough side or the smooth side, which is quite insightful.
I quite like doing family top trumps.
Oh, yeah, nice.
So it's like they score the family members, and sometimes they want to draw them, or sometimes you find little, like, character pictures, and they create, like, and you have a set of questions like, how safe do they make you feel, how happy do they make you feel, how angry. And I think if kids like the game of top trumps, then that's quite a fun way to explore their family.
Yeah, I like that one. I've not used top trumps. That's good.
Yeah.
The other things I was think about is you might look at, well, who knows about your sexual behavior? So circle all the people in the family that know. Is there anybody that isn't on that family tree that knows about the behaviour? Because you get some young people and half the street know. And then you've also got to think about their safety, about people knowing and how they've reacted and if there's a risk from the community. Or just that it might tell you that parents are actually sharing a lot of this information with lots of people and how that would feel for a child, knowing that, you know, Tina at number 7 knows about what I've done. So I think that can be quite useful to find out how they know, how they reacted, because they might have had a lot of rejections in their lives. So that's quite useful. Or anyone you didn't want to know. So you can kind of explore it in lots of different ways.
I quite like the Three Islands as well, which is really good for actually lots of ages of children, generally sort of younger ones, where you might have an island of always, sometimes and never. And I would physically, or they would physically, cut out paper to represent each of the islands and stick it on a kind of paper sea. And, you know, and they are always on the always island because they're always with themselves. And then you ask them to populate the islands with the people that they want to have with them always, that they want to have with them just some of the time, and the people that they never want to have them. But I do have to make sure, for some children, I have to say, this isn't real and it won't come true. So you might want to put someone on the never island. And also that sort of safe space, reminding them about confidentiality. We're not going to share this with anybody. So if your mum or dad or your nan needs to go on the Never Island because you really don't have a good relationship with them, that's okay. We're not going to tell them. And it's, I always think that brings out some really interesting information about who might be the most important one. So I encourage them to put pets on, because sometimes I've seen some young people that the only people they want with them all the time is their dog. And that's really helpful to think about kind of the strengths and resilience that their child may or may not have.
I think sometimes as well, so some of the young people we see might be quite anxious, or they might find it really hard to sit still. So sometimes you could use different pieces of paper at different points in the room, so the child can physically go and move things to that rather than just a piece of paper in front of you. And that can be a way to help them deal with those feelings of anxiety and the need to move around. And I think that's the thing, you have to give permission. You're not encouraging children to be running around the room or anything. You're trying to do it in a contained way. But recognising that kids struggle to sit still, especially when they're sort of feeling really awkward and embarrassed.
I think a proper formal family tree as well is a really useful assessment tool that we should be including in our assessment reports anyway. Yeah. It's helpful sometimes where we've got lots and lots of kind of safeguarding issues for a family or lots of abuse. It's really helpful to colour code those. So sometimes you might colour code all of those who have maybe experienced abuse, all of those who've kind of displayed abusive behaviours. Sometimes you need to colour in both, for, you know, because people have done both. That's a really good visual tool to highlight safeguarding concerns as well.
Would you do that with the child, or would that be something you did more sort of when you're back in the office and you're looking at the case?
It would depend on the child. I think for some young people, they're able to do that piece of work and it's a really helpful cathartic thing to do. And for some young people, it absolutely isn't. And, you know, it needs to be done away from them and sharing with the professional network in terms of a safeguarding response. Yeah.
So in terms of, you're talking about the general family, and I suppose what we should say as well is that for some children, what is actually the most painful thing to talk about isn't the HSB, it's the family.
Yeah.
So we need to be sensitive with that, that talking about family trees and creating things like that can actually bring a lot of sort of difficult feelings for children. So it's being sensitive about that. And the more you know about a child, the more you can talk to professionals and family members or carers about what their background's like, the more sensitive and the easier it is to be sensitive about those sort of issues. And also, we don't know who might not be safe people in their family. So we might think talking about somebody, a specific family member's fine, but actually to them, that's really painful.
Yeah, so I guess it's never forcing them, is it? Never pushing them. And in every kind of bit of work we do, it's about trying to be mindful and read their body language and reflect back to them. So you look, I'm wondering if you're feeling a bit uncomfortable about doing this. You don't have to do it.
Yeah.
That's fine. I guess that's important in terms of, again, that therapeutic relationship we talked about previously.
And some children we work with have never maybe had a lot of sort of family members regulating their emotions. So actually the process of reflecting back what you're observing in the change of their body, they might not be in tune with how they feel, especially young people who get very angry very quickly, but they didn't see the warning signs as they started to build. But we as professionals might start to notice that they're starting to breathe heavier or look uncomfortable or tense their jaw. And there are opportunities, aren't they, to sort of name that for them?
Yeah.
Before it gets to the point that they pop.
Yeah.
And then they feel angry and they can no longer sort of engage. In terms of moving the conversation on, so you started that conversation of getting to know them, finding about their background. You're then starting to move really to talking about sex. It might be more generically rather than straight into harmful sexual behaviour. What are some of the kind of ways that you could approach talking about sex with young people?
So I think it's really helpful when you're having, prior to having kind of your sessions that are going to directly explore the HSB, that you've had other sessions with them that are more explicit about sex, because it's about sort of gradually building that up, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's going to be more difficult to talk about their own sexual behaviour than sex in general. Yeah. So, and it's really helpful to understand what their sexual knowledge is and whether it's appropriate or not for their age. So I think it's helpful where possible to do that in line with whatever PHSE, RSE they're getting in school, so that you're sort of giving the message in the same way and reinforcing it in that positive way. So working with your professional partners is helpful. I'd really want to explore their understanding around consent. So one of the ways I might do that is create a series of vignettes, like really short narratives. So and once you've created them once, you can use them in lots of different ways. So it's not a waste of time in that respect, that describe kind of some sexual interactions and encounters, and ask them to say whether or not they think that scenario shows consent or not, and then spend a bit of time unpicking why they think that and supporting them with the law. You know, what the law says: you have to be over 16, you have to be free to consent, and you have to have the capacity or understanding to what you're consenting to. So I'd really want to kind of drill down on how much they understand about what the law says. So using consent scenarios is a really helpful way. And again, talking about it in a third party way is less challenging. Mm. At the end of that session, I might then ask the question, oh, do you think, when you think about what happened with whoever, whatever the HSB was, do you think that there was consent in that? So it's then asking them to reflect on their own behaviour.
We also might look at where they've got sexual knowledge from. So just asking them to sort of say every place that they might have got sexual knowledge, and you can prompt them a bit, can't you? And then whether they think they're good places to get accurate information. And that's a good place where talking about peers telling them things or viewing pornography is a really, it's a good kind of gentle way in, isn't it? To start that conversation and say, you know, do you think pornography is an accurate way to depict what sex is like, what consent is like, what healthy relationships are like? But it's not going into straight into, do you watch pornography?
Yeah.
Where they can feel that's sort of quite confronting.
And if they can't, you know, verbally discuss it, there are lots of other things you can do. So you could print off just on kind of bullet points all the different ways that children might learn about sex, and then ask them to just move those pieces of paper with those bullet points onto like a safe way, unsafe, or not sure. So it's like it's less requirement on them to verbalize it.
Yeah.
And the same, you know, if they can't do stuff about consent verbally, you could do same about good and bad touch. So give them lots and lots of different examples of touch, including not just sexual touch, like it could be punching someone, hitting someone, brushing someone's hair, and asking them to put in like a good column, bad column, not sure, or both. Because it's, again, it's less pressurizing for that child.
Yeah. So there's some of the ways there's lots of ways, isn't there, to talk about sex. And I know if we had a longer podcast, we could kind of go on for quite a long time. So we've talked about the general getting to know you. We've talked a little bit about starting to explore sex. What about approaching talking about the harmful sexual behaviour? I think we've got two that we particularly want to talk about, which was cartooning and Finkel Horse. So can you talk a little bit about cartooning?
Yeah, so when we talked about the timeline, we said one of the things you can do is kind of then create a much shorter timeline that really sort of drills down on the events of that specific day or week of whatever time frame is relevant. And another way of doing that is to cartoon out the sexual behaviour. And let's be clear, we don't need to be expert drawers. I'm talking about stick figures here.
My cartoons are dreadful, but they find it funny. They laugh at my
and artistic skills. And actually makes for a more lighthearted session, because I'll say I am clearly very rubbish at drawing. And what I will do is create the sort of cartoon slides and cut them out individually prior to the session, but I also bring a bunch of blank ones as well.
Yeah.
And that's based on the information that we have about the harmful sexual behaviour incident. So it's really important we have as much information as we can prior to doing the session, so that we can challenge and bring what we already know. And then all I will ask the young person to do is to put those slides in order initially.
Yeah.
That kind of circumnavigates denial, because I'm not asking them directly if it happened. I'm just asking to put it in order. Fill out any slides where there's gaps. And once we've got them in order, then I might start to ask them to think about how they were feeling. We might use feeling cards if they can't name it. And then we might go, so how were you feeling just before? So in slide three, where you're, you know, just walking home from school, kind of how were you feeling? And then when you walk through the door, and then an hour later you were looking at pornography, how were you feeling? And then half an hour before, you know, the sexual behaviour happened, how were you feeling? So it kind of really drilling down, and then helping that young person identify, when did the thought come into their head? When did they start to plan it? Because a lot of young people will say, I didn't plan it, it just happened. And what we know is nothing ever just happens.
Cartoon's really good to slow it down, isn't it? And really get down to the, you know, how... So you were thinking about that, but then how did you end up in such and such a buddy's bedroom?
Yeah.
So how did you get from the point of having that thought, lying in your bedroom watching porn, getting to that bedroom? There's a process, there's a physical barrier of the door that you had to kind of open it. So it's breaking that down into really small sort of bite-sized things for them to start to reflect, because ultimately what you're looking for is where were the points that they could have stopped.
Yes.
So if they're in a situation in the future where they start to get those thoughts and feelings again, what are their warning signs? How could they stop themselves at different points? And that could be part of their strategy then for their safety plan.
Exactly. So I think when you've done that kind of that first layer of cartooning, then you can start to add the thoughts and feelings that were happening at various points. And then you could take it a step further and ask them to think about what they think the children impacted by their behaviour might have been thinking and feeling and recognising, because a lot of children will say, well, I don't know, I'm not them. But you say, okay, but I just want you to think about it. How do you imagine they might have been? And really,
well, what did their face show? How was their face at the time? Well, what emotion do you think they were feeling then if their face looked like that?
Yeah, and it's also a helpful tool to think about whether or not the kind of response of other children is sufficient barrier for them to stop. Did they stop at the point that they recognised this child was uncomfortable, not consenting? Or did they see that they were uncomfortable and not consenting, but carry on? Mm. And that changes our risk assessment slightly. You were going to talk a little bit about Finkelhor model.
Yeah, so Finkelhor is a bit of a contentious one because I think different people have different feelings over it, because ultimately it is a model that was written for work with adult sex offenders. And I think we need to be really, really clear. These are children, whether they're children or they're young people. These are not adults. They're not mini sex offenders. They're children, and they needed to be treated and talked to in a nurturing way. They're not sophisticated. And in terms of their offences and thought processes, and we need to be clear about that. Despite that, I actually still find Finkelhor's a really useful way of helping young people understand. And again, I think we do have to think about children's levels of understanding. So there might be some children that this is a bit too complicated for. They might find this a bit challenging. So you do need to get to know your child and their learning style. So if you're going to use Finkelhor, you do need to read around it, understand it, decide if it's suitable for that child. But basically, you're looking at, the first thing is having a sexual motivation. So it's like the thinking stage. It's that impulse to do the behaviour. It's around the feelings and fantasies of a child. Then you've got to overcome internal inhibitions. So it's giving yourself permission. So most young people know that that behaviour is wrong, but they do something to convince themselves that it's not that bad, sort of minimise it. They then need to overcome all the external barriers. So it's like creating the opportunity. So like we talked about in the using cartooning, if the door was shut, they had to go through the door. So there's certain things that they need to do. And then it's overcoming victim resistance. Now, that can sound like that's going to be a very threatening thing that they might have to do. But actually, sometimes it's just that person trusted them because it might have been a sibling. And that's really sad. But it doesn't mean that they have actually done something very forceful. It might be that they have.
Yeah.
And it's understanding that, because, again, each of these steps offer an opportunity to look at what allowed them to get to the next step, but also what things do we need to put in place. If you imagine it like hurdles, and they had to, or a brick wall, and they've got to climb over that wall to get over the first step, how can we make that wall bigger in the future for them? How can we make it harder for them to get over it?
Yeah.
Because we start to work on those internal thought processes that will help them think differently in the future.
Yeah.
I think you can do that on paper, can't you? You can do it. But other ways you can do it is things like having four chairs. I don't know, have you ever done it with four chairs?
No.
Right,
okay. Sounds really good.
So sometimes we put four chairs out, and then for each of the stages, we ask the child to sit in that seat as though they're at that point of the process of thinking. So in that moment, they haven't got to think about all the stages, just that one stage, and that can sometimes help them. It's also that physical movement makes them feel a bit more comfortable. But it is one where I think you do need to spend time thinking about how you're going to approach it. But I have had some of my most successful sessions using it, because they've really got down to what they were thinking and feeling at such a deep level that has been the thing that's really enabled me to help create a sort of a realistic safety plan.
Yeah, I really like it as a strategy. I think, like you say, for the right child, it can be a really fantastic way of helping them kind of understand their behaviour. I do think it's helpful when you're introducing it to use a non-sexual story, like stealing from a sweet shop, in order to introduce the idea that you can kind of role play out is less
threatening.
Eating
a cream cake's quite a good one, or smoking.
That kind of thing first. But yeah, a really good strategy.
I think in general, what I suppose our message would be really is that doing this work, you need to develop a toolkit. You can't go into this work and think you can just sit down and have a chat with a piece of flip chart. You will need to spend time to prepare, time to create stuff so that when you go, you're confident and clear and you can make it as easy for the child to engage in that process as possible.
Yeah.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. The third episode, which will be released next week, will look at technology-assisted harmful sexual behaviour.
Thanks for listening to this NSPCC Learning podcast. At the time of recording, this episode's content was up to date, but the world of safeguarding and child protection is ever-changing. So, if you're looking for the most current safeguarding and child protection training, information or resources, please visit our website for professionals at nspcc.org.uk/learning.